Is this a party or what? I have played this building with Stars on Ice probably 5 or 6 times. There's never been this many people in this building when we perform Stars on Ice every single time. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Just kind of feel like getting into the... Everybody doing well? This is your opening ceremonies. You guys got to get crazy. I have to be honest. I was really excited about coming and speaking here, and then the realities of it kind of sunk in. It was like, okay, how many people am I speaking for? Oh, about 18,000. 18,000? Yes, 3 times. Oh, man. And they're so young, they have no idea about anything that I've ever done. Have anybody ever, this is a loaded question, has anybody ever seen me skate before? Wow. Okay, because I was freaking out. When I was coming here, I was like, normally what I talk about is, you know, all the stuff I've had to go through, you know, with the skating and then all the my unique hobby of collecting life-threatening illnesses. But you see me skate, I don't have to introduce myself to you again. And because my last-ditch thing is for younger people, I'd say, has anybody ever seen Blades of Glory? Yeah. I was in that. So here we are. This is so exciting. I mean, I can't believe I'm speaking to so many amazing young people that are just so driven and so headed in the right direction. It just fills my heart with hope and optimism, and that's not what I had driving here from Nashville, Tennessee. I was sitting there going, what am I going to talk about? I mean, this is a whole unique kind of group of people. I mean, how am I going to relate? I mean, how am I going to, because, you know, they're most of them are in high school, you know, a lot of them are, you know, just a couple years out. I mean, how am I going to relate to these people? I'm kind of way past that. And then I started to laugh. I started to laugh thinking about when I was your age. And it was just, it was the most fun ride I've had, you know, driving to an event. Beautiful drive, by the way. I mean, the colors are spectacular. But I started thinking about the clothes that I wore back then. Does anybody watch that 70s show? That was me. Bell-bottom pants, the big belt, leather vest, big print shirt. Yeah. You look back on those pictures now and it's like, oh man, I thought I was cool. So I'm just telling you that you're going to experience this not too far in the future. It's amazing to look back at those high school years when you think of the clothes you wore, hair, hairstyles. Believe it or not, I had one. It started off being kind of stringy and long and bangs. I had bangs and I'd always want them to kind of part over to the side, so I'd always do this to them. And I thought in high school I was really cool because I had these straight bangs and I had a little thing at the bottom. And my hair was so bad that my coach, going into a national competition, said, you can't go out there like that. So she made me curl my hair, like into an afro. No, there's no surviving that. I mean, that was brutal. So I had this kind of afro thing, and it was really kind of curly and ridiculous looking. And I didn't want to face anybody, but I had to go out in front of all these people and compete in a national championship. Thank goodness I won. But as I started to let this thing kind of take on a life of its own, I just sort of let it grow and get really big because I wanted to look like Roger Daltrey. Does anybody know Roger Daltrey is? Not so much. Lead singer of The Who. They did the football game a few years ago in the Super Bowl halftime. But I let this thing get really big, and I thought I was really cool in my leather vest and my shirt and my big bell-bottom pants and doing this as much as I could to let it move. And then I kind of let that go, and then it became a mullet. Remember that? You saw a little bit of that, the mullet, because it kind of goes, you know, kind of short bangs, a little short on the top, and then it gets really long in the back. chick magnet I was. And then, you know, you kind of deal with that, and you start to get an island back here because you're getting older, and then that kind of starts its life of its own. And then I had to go through chemotherapy, which took it all off, and thank goodness I don't have that anymore. 30 seconds in the shower, $11 at Great Clips. I'm out of there in 5 minutes. I am the luckiest guy in the world that I no longer have to live with that hair that I almost had. And then you think about, you know, the music you listened to back then. Man, you're thinking about the Beatles, thinking about the Rolling Stones, thinking about Led Zeppelin. See? My parents hated it. Hated it. And I'm sure your parents hate a lot of the music you listen to now, am I right? Not so happy about it? Well, I didn't like their music either. My dad said they're also monotone. None of them can sing. Now, listen to this. Perry Como, he can sing. So there's always that battle of dealing with my parents and the music aspect of everything. And then there's the first car. How many of y'all have a first car? Yeah. Yeah, it takes some time, and it's a big process. My first car was a 1966 Volkswagen Bug. You liked it a lot more than I did. It had a roof, like one of those sunroofs, and it leaked all the time, and it never started in the morning, especially when it got cold, about the time when I'd be training for my competitions, and it was just magical. I look back on those days and I think, wow, those were some of the greatest days of my life. The promise that, you know, feeling good when you get up in the morning instead of now, when things are a little bit creaky and out of shape. But what you're living right now is truly spectacular. It's an amazing opportunity for y'all to just find yourselves, find out who you want to be, and take those skills and change the world. I mean, I'm sounding like a really bad graduation commencement speech, but it's true. I look at the people now. I have two young boys. You saw a picture of them. And they're amazing. They're so fresh, and they look at things in their own way, and they have their own personalities, and they're each completely different than each other. And I just look at them, and I just get so full. My heart gets so full about what the world has to offer them. And then I look at you, and I saw you all walking in. Everybody's wearing their blue jackets, and they're all walking. I'm driving in today, and I was just looking at everybody, and everybody looks so tall. See, that's another thing that I was kind of feeling doomed about. Your theme this year is grow. I did very little of that, but here we are. We're all about growth. We're all about opportunity. And we're all about making the world a better place. I competed in two Olympic Games, one in 1980 where the hockey team beat the Soviet Union and won the Olympic gold medal. Notice I didn't say anything about my participation there, came in fifth. But Eric Heiden won 5 Olympic gold medals. He won every single event he participated in. He won every distance. Can you imagine that? You win the marathon all the way through the 100-yard dash. Eric Heiden did that at that Olympics. And I was just there as a great tourist. It was amazing to be able to be in Lake Placid, New York, a home hosted Olympic Games, and to be able to, and I don't know how it happened, but I got voted to carry the flag into the opening ceremonies. And I can tell you this, there has never in the history of the Olympics have they had a smaller male athlete in the Olympic Games. My hat was so big that it kept coming down over my nose. My mittens were about out to here. My shoes, my boots were about 3 sizes too big, and I had to carry the flag in the opening ceremonies. So I'm sitting there, and I got the flag in my hands, and I'm just nervous because, you know, it's nothing fit, and I'm tripping over myself, and my hat kept coming down in my nose, and I'm trying to carry the flag, and everybody looking at me must have thought I had some sort of condition because I'm just walking and doing this. And as we came into the stadium, there was a ramp up. And then there was a plateau, and as we came in, the American people at the opening ceremonies, they saw the tip of the flag, and they just erupted into this huge applause, and the feeling was just enormous, a great pride. And then I got to the top of the ramp, and I looked down, and there was a ramp covered with ice, going down to the field, and I'm thinking, oh no, nothing fits. I can't even see where I'm going, and I gotta go down this ramp, and all I could think about was, figure skater wipes out with Old Glory in opening ceremony, film at 6, 11, morning news, noon, 6, and 11 for the rest of his life. And I came to the top of the thing, and I can turn sideways, and I walked down, and as we made our way, survived, got through it, and it was just an extraordinary experience to represent the United States in that way. And then, you know, came the next 4 years, where I was lucky enough to kind of navigate an amazing run of never losing a competition over a four-year period of time, and that ended with an Olympic gold medal in 1984. And it's amazing, because, you know, you're standing on that podium at an Olympic Games, and it's just a dream that you've dreamed about every single day, about, I'm training for this opportunity. And as you're standing there, and they're playing the national anthem, you're looking over the edge of the platform, and it looks like a cliff. Who am I now? Whoever I was all the way up to this moment in time, that person no longer exists, because everything tomorrow begins brand new. I'm no longer training for this opportunity. Now it's happened. And then you think about all the people that made it happen. The coaches, my parents, the people that would house me when I was training in other cities around the country, and just doctors, choreographers, and just everyone that made that moment happen, my friends that I trained with. And it's something that I'll never forget, because it seems like a solitary moment, but it's one that you're sharing with an entire nation. Kind of like what you're doing with this organization. You may be individuals, but you're all tied together by a common purpose and a common cause that just elevates you to a whole another level of appreciation and support. So what happens after you win Olympic Games? What happens? Well, now people just start training for the next Olympic Games, but back then we had things called the Icecapades. Has anyone ever seen an Icecapades? You're too young. See, here's what happens when I go into the Icecapades. I came in and they said, well, you're a guy, but you won the Olympics. So, I mean, you're too short to be in the line, but now that you won the Olympics, we'll give you a job and you can skate. And I said, I won't let you down, sir. I won't let you down. I'm going to give you 100%. And so for 2 years, I had a two-year contract with a one-year option. I said, I'll never miss a show. I'll be there for every press engagement, and I'm going to be the best employee you've ever had. And they said, okay, sure. No one's ever done that before, but we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. So for 2 years, I never missed a show. I even took over for other athletes that were injured, and I was the best employee I could possibly ever be. And you know what happened? After 2 years, a new owner came in, and he said, I don't want a male star. Don't you hate sexual discrimination in the workplace? I mean, really? So after 2 years, I was out of a job. And so I had to get to work. I had to find my way. I had to kind of instantly learn how to be an entrepreneur. And so I formed a show called Stars on Ice. I know, because you said so earlier, has anyone in this crowd ever seen a Stars on Ice show? Yeah, not so many. Has anyone seen Icecapades lately? No, this is passive aggression. Icecapades went out of business. I guess they didn't have enough guys to sell tickets for them, did they? But it was in my journey of creating this tour and this opportunity for myself that I realized that, you know, it can only go so far. And about 11 years into the building of this tour, we were doing really well. We all worked really hard. We did everything we needed to do to kind of build an audience and create popularity. And we had great skaters like Christy Yamaguchi and Paul Wiley and Kurt Browning and all these amazing stars in skating. And I was on the ice with them, but I almost wanted their autographs. But I was having a hard time. I was having a hard time standing up straight all the way, and I thought maybe I just worked too hard. And after about 50 cities of a 60-city tour, I decided to go in and check it out. Found out that I had a mass. A mass. No one's ever used the word mass in any description of me ever, a mass. What can it be? They said, well, it's either benign, malignant, or something else. And it was in that moment that I realized that I was diagnosed with cancer. And my world just exploded. I can't have cancer. I'm busy. I got this tour to be on. I can't have cancer. That means I'm sick. I can't have cancer. And I just freaked out. So I decided that I needed to get some sort of, somebody tell me what to do. So I called my manager, who I started Stars and Ice with, and I said, Bob, are you sitting down? And he said, yes. And I go, no, you're not. I need you to sit down. And so he sat down. And I said, I've just been diagnosed with cancer. And I could tell that I just knocked the wind out of him. And he goes, well, where are you? And I go, I'm in Peoria. And he goes, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm about to go skate in an ice show. And he goes, you're going to skate? And I go, yeah, I skated last night. I'll skate tonight. It just hurts. And he said, well, what are you going to do? And I go, I don't know. So I was calling you. And he said, well, why don't you get on your bus tonight after the show and come to Cleveland? I'll take care of everything. Cleveland, Ohio! And so that night was going to be the last show I ever performed in. I was being very melodramatic. My last show. So I put on my skates, and I noticed they were glowing a little bit. And I got ready to do the show, my last show ever. Is that kind of like William Shatner? Last show ever. And I was really just sad and just devastated. And I went out for the opening number, and I landed everything. Did a big backflip at the end, and I was like, wow, that went well. And then in my first half number, I'm going out, and it's a comedy number, and I'm trying to be funny, and I go out, and I land everything, and I do a big backflip at the end, and full standing ovation. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I'm good at cancer. Who knew? So I go into the second half number, and I'm feeling kind of okay. I got this big number called I Who Have Nothing. For those of you that watch American Idol, they did this show a few years ago, and it's a very sad song about somebody who has nothing, and he's unrequited love, and I'm out there, and I'm just getting into the character, and I'm so sad, and I'm just feeling horrible, and I got to do my biggest, toughest jump, which I've fallen on in this corner so many times, and I'm just sort of like feeling sad, and I look into the front row, and there's a woman, a beautiful woman sitting there. She could care less what I was doing. And it completely broke the spell. I just started laughing. And I went into the triple lutz, and I kind of landed it, and I wobbled me. And the rest of the time, I realized that this is my battle. This is my journey. This is my problem. And I am going to deal with it with every single thing that I've got. It's amazing how fear can instantly turn into courage. You don't know how it happens. But it's amazing that when you're thinking that you're right there and everything's up against you, there's a switch that goes off that tells you that you're going to be okay because you're going to fight this thing with everything you've got. So I went to the Cleveland Clinic. The Cleveland Clinic! And they told me, they said, Mr. Hamilton, you have a stage 3 germ cell tumor, testicular in its origin, and we recommend, I go, wait a minute, stop. What did you say? And they go, we know what kind of cancer you have. And I go, what kind of cancer is that? And they go, so you have testicular cancer. And it's like, no. No. And they go, no, I can't. I can't. No, it's got to be something else. And they go, no, what's your problem? I go, I'm going to have to talk about this. I'm going to have to go on the Today Show. Okay, I'll talk to Matt about this, but not Katie, because this is just too weird to be. This is my, come on. And so they go, no, you need to take this seriously. I said, no, I don't. What I need to do is take this journey the way that I need to take this journey. There will be no lower lips. None of this. No lower lips. There will be no sadness. There will be no pity. There will be no, how could this happen to you? There'll be none of that. I want joy. I want levity. I want lightness. And it was there that the quote came out, "The only true disability in life is a bad attitude." Think about it. We can overcome anything in this world if we have the right attitude. And all of you, I know, do, because you are here in this room tonight. The only disability in life is a bad attitude. So I had my chemo, lost all my hair, fine with me. I went through different periods of illness. I went on the internet to find out what I could find, and I couldn't find anything that would tell me what I needed to know. All these things happened, and I just kept trying to keep my eye on the prize, just survive and get back to work. And then I had a major surgery, 38 staples. Tough one. And I was so scared in the operating room, and they said, "Why are you so fearful?" And I said, "Have you guys ever done one of these before?" And they go, "Yeah, we've done 7 this year." I said, "Let's go." Surviving cancer was one of the greatest things I've ever experienced. My mother died of cancer, so I knew what was at stake. But it was a great thing to know that I could be a survivor and I could make a difference in the cancer community. So we've started websites, we've started patient support programs, and we're funding research like you wouldn't believe. Cancer picked the wrong person, because I'm going to fight it with everything I have in my survivorship. It's an extraordinary thing to have that feeling that you can do something to make a difference in somebody else's life. And so in my survivorship, I decided I had to be alone. I had to be by myself. Where can you be alone in the United States? Truly alone. Thought about it. And I moved to Los Angeles, California. Where's the LA gang? LA! California! All right. So I was in LA. I was kind of working it out. I was kind of feeling my way, because I lived in Denver for 23 years. Denver! Come on, you guys. You can do better than that. Where's Denver? Colorado! All right. And it's there that I met my wife. And she's an extraordinary person. Simply the kindest, most beautiful person I've ever met. And we were just, you know, it was an instant thing. The second we met, we knew something was special. And we decided to get married and start a family. But with my health issues, we didn't know how that was going to work. 9 months and 2 days after we got married, my son Aiden was born. I guess that wasn't going to be a problem. And it was about 14 months later that I realized that something was different. My life was different. I decided to get off the road to be with my family. And it was there that I just felt down, depressed. Did I miss skating? What was going on? And I realized that something physically was wrong. And so I went back to the Cleveland Clinic the day before my cancer benefit that I put on every year. And I went through a series of tests. And after they did a head scan, the doctor said, "There's something in there. I think Dr. Klein will be waiting for you back in his examination room." And he was. I was diagnosed with a pituitary brain tumor. And that's what was causing all my problems. My family was coming, and how do I tell my wife? I knew that I had to share this with her immediately, because I mean, I had to. I was, you know, husband and father, and I had all these responsibilities, and I wanted to share this with her as soon as I could. They came in. Tracy goes, "What's going on?" I go, "I'll tell you upstairs." So we went up to the room, and my son was on the floor, and he's 14 months old, and he's banging on the telephone, and he's playing, and she said, "What's happening?" I go, "I've just been diagnosed with a brain tumor." And she immediately took my hands without hesitation. She put her head down, and she started to pray. And it was simply the most powerful moment I've ever had in my life. Because the first place we went was the best place we could go. And I knew no matter what, I was going to be just fine. Pituitary brain tumor, as you can see, I'm not very tall. When they did the biopsy, they take a needle down to the top of your head and they say, "We seem to have found a safe passage. You should be okay. Should be okay. Seem to have found a safe passage." And it was there that they found out that I was born with this brain tumor. It's usually found in young children who don't grow very fast or develop very well. And those are all the Those were all the symptoms I had when I was younger that got me into skating. So people ask, don't you feel cursed? You've had cancer, you've had a brain tumor. And I said, how can I feel cursed? The disease took my mother and I survived, and I had a brain tumor, and without that brain tumor, I never would have become the person that I became. So how could I feel cursed? See, it's the choice. It's the decision that we make to turn something horrible or challenging into something that you can feel was a blessing in disguise. All of us are going to have our great challenges. We're all going to have something that's going to knock us down. And as a skater, I can tell you that you're going to fall down a lot. But what do you do when you fall down? What do you do? Get up. What do you do? What do you do? And if you fall again, what do you do? If somebody knocks you down, what do you do? Exactly. And that's what I learned. I got knocked down. I got knocked down so many times. What do? You get up. There's so many things happening in this world right now that we have very little control over. Or do we? We have a very divided political battle going on that I'm not even going to get into. But what I can tell you is that you are the cream of the crop. And I mean crop. I use that word specifically. You are creating an amazing opportunity by providing one of a human being's three basic needs, food and water. We've gotten more involved in this in the Second Harvest Food Bank in Nashville, Tennessee. It's an organization I love dearly, and Janie Day, who runs it, is a woman I just adore. And her service, what she gives to people, has grown each year. How ironic, in a country that suffers from obesity in large numbers, that we have so many people that are hungry. It's amazing, isn't it? What a diversity, what a dichotomy. It's just incredible what we can do to make this country and this planet healthier. And that's what I'm depending on all of you to accomplish. My wife is the nicest person I've ever met, the kindest, most loving person I've ever known. And she, a couple years ago, could not tear herself away from the television when Haiti was hit by that horrible earthquake. She just couldn't look away. She was heartbroken that people live in this kind of poverty and this kind of devastation, and this loss of life was just so extraordinary. And she said, what can we do? What can we do? And a friend of ours who's very involved in a philanthropic organization said, there's a lot of people there now, a lot of people doing good work. We can't get in their way. You can help them, but wait. There's a lot of people down there doing great work, but if you want to do something that sustains, wait. And so she did. She kept the lights on. She wanted to know exactly what was going on out there, and she just waited. And sure enough, the right person, the right organization was presented to her. A group called MMDR out of Nashville, Tennessee, and they service the world in the worst places. They go to only the worst places to give medical and humanitarian relief to those that they can, but they're a very small organization. And what they're doing in Haiti is truly significant. Tracy's gone down three times this year, and they are feeding those that have nothing. They're giving medical treatments to those who have nothing. And for those that may not be understanding truly of what's going on in Haiti, they have nothing. It's simply the poorest country in the world. And it'll take you longer to get to Miami than it will for you to get from Miami to Port-au-Prince from here. It's that close. It's that close. They're starving. And starving to death is not a good way to go. That's what Dr. Vanderpool tells us all the time on his medical missions that he does all over the world. But he's dedicated to Haiti. And I think all of us should be dedicated to Haiti. You guys are putting together food packs. Your goal is 1 million food packs. Somehow you're going to do it. Half of them are going to stay here in Indiana, and half of them are going to Haiti. And I can tell you that you've already done 192,000 food packs that are going to feed the hungry. I'm so proud of you all for that, but I'm also so proud of you for dedicating yourselves to your life's ambition, and that is to feed everyone, feed the hungry, come up with better food choices, healthier food choices. It's amazing. I've just seen so many beautiful, intelligent life faces here, and it's just a thrill for me to be standing in front of you to thank you on behalf of all of those that you will serve. I heard a sermon once recently that was given to youth, and I'm going to end it the way they did. Okay, you can be good, do good. Here's something better. FFA, do you hear me? Be amazing. That is my wish for all of you. Thank you for your attention. Enjoy your conference. Thank you. Thank you so much.